This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
We've just finished our January 2021 Trumpet print edition, and the cover story by Gerald Fleury, Why Donald Trump Will Remain America's President. There on the cover, we have a picture, a painting by Gary Dorning of President Trump leaning against a big gavel, standing on a sound block. The headline, Rule of Law, Why the President Will Prevail. But you look around, and the pressure on Donald Trump to concede America's election is overwhelming. It's practically unanimous, at least it feels that way. Yesterday, though, his legal team gave over an hour and a half press conference laying out the case that there was fraud everywhere. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, last week, President Trump's lawyer, Sidney Powell, promised to release the Kraken on voter fraud. And so since then, everyone's been anxiously watching the seas to see whether a Kraken emerges or not. But this week, there's really between the press conference yesterday and then comments she gave on the Greg Kelly reports on Tuesday are kind of our first indications that there may actually be a Kraken ready to burst out of the waters. Particularly the report on Tuesday where she's laying out that she has a sworn affidavit from a high-ranking Venezuelan military officer. She's posted sections of it on Twitters, but still keeping the whole thing a bit under wraps till you get some of the legal reports. But the system that she's at least alleging they used was actually evil, but quite ingenious. Where she's saying that this Dominion software, as according to this affidavit, how it works is the logarithms can flip a certain percentage of votes from the candidate you don't want president to the candidate you do want president. And by flipping that certain percentage, it's very subtle. That's really one of the big problems you have when you're trying to rig an election, is that you don't know how many votes you have to rig until after the election. Mm. And you don't want to overguess too much because it looks suspicious. So this report, it flips a certain percentage. So as you're watching the vote tallies go up, it'll go up naturally as votes ebb and flow over the course of the election night, but just ever so slightly higher than what actually happened in reality. Hmm. She said the problem they had with the software, though, is they underestimated how many votes President Trump actually received on election night. And so about halfway through the evening, they realized that even with the rigging, he was still going to win. And so had to stop counting votes for 5 hours while they adjusted things. Hmm. And that's why you saw the blurb everyone's been talking about, where the Biden votes, they're going up, 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 up. Trump's still in the lead. And then all of a sudden, at 1 hour, it just jumps up 0.5%. Mm-hmm. And then Biden lapped Trump all at once. We think, well, normally if it was natural, if he's just getting, you say it's the way they explain this. They say, well, he's just getting more mail-in ballots at the end of the evening. You're like, okay, well, the mail-in ballots, the slope of the curve should increase. Yeah. But it shouldn't just jump. And so at least for her assessment is that they probably would have gotten away with this if they would have set that flip algorithm slightly higher before the whole thing started. Because they set it so low, they had to stop. There was a blurb. People got suspicious. People started looking into it. And according to her testimony, if she really has the Kraken to back this up, she's claiming that it flipped 6 to 7 million votes to Joe Biden, which means that instead of getting around 73 million votes, Trump got 80 million votes, mm-hmm. which actually would make him the winner of the popular vote as well of the Electoral College if mm-hmm. that if those allegations can be proved.
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it? It's amazing to me, though, in this press conference that the legal team held yesterday, how hostile the media were to everything that they were saying, and still so willing to dismiss all of these allegations and just saying, well, there's nothing to prove, there's no evidence here. When they're basically saying this is the direction that we're taking, and we have the evidence, we're going to lay it all out in a court of law. Stephen Fleury on the Trumpet Daily Show this last week has been pointing to just the remarkable hypocrisy and double standard between those who have spent the last 4 years basically promoting the idea that Donald Trump was guilty based on no evidence, and just saying that, you know, they're taking it to the bank that he was an agent in the pocket of the Russians and so on, versus hundreds of affidavits, all of the evidence that this legal team has been accumulating. They've only been at this for 2 weeks, and they're just saying, well, this is just ridiculous.
Right, and it is amazing, just given the short time frame. I mean, that's what kind of keeps everyone on suspense here, is it's not, the Electoral College vote's coming up on December 14th. That's only 3 weeks away. The law states that the states have to have their elections certified
right.
about a week before then. So you've only got
it's a very
like
short
two weeks left. And what they've, what you've uncovered in just, 2 weeks of research and only 2 weeks to go has been amazing. And so if this is the evidence that overturns the election, I mean, it's definitely going to be the Kraken was a good analogy, because it's going to be a very dramatic reveal.
Well, we all definitely are on the edge of our seats watching this unfold, and there are so many storylines. I think Stephen Fleury has just done a remarkable job of keeping up with all of these on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Listen to that show every morning. If you have not been, you definitely need to be keeping up with that. I would encourage you to look at that and stay tuned for that cover story, Why Donald Trump Will Remain America's President. It's really an expansion of what he wrote in his Trumpet brief a week ago on Monday. So a lot to watch in this situation. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Donald Trump is not resting. He continues to do his job as president, and one priority he keeps pushing forward is to draw down American troops from overseas deployments. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, the United States government has announced that it intends to draw down forces in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Currently, there are, in terms of Afghanistan, there are about 5,000 forces there, and they want the number to be down to about 2,500. And then inside Iraq, there are currently 3,000 troops, and that will be drawn down to 2,500 also. And this is set to take place by January 15th. And this is something that the Trump administration has said it has wanted to do, to get out of these Middle Eastern entanglements where it doesn't see a future, or at least in terms of strict American interests with boots on the ground. And so he's continuing this policy. What's also interesting is the other region that wasn't included in this announcement, although there have been reports that have leaked that the United States is also planning to remove forces from Somalia as well. Somalia, just on the Horn of Africa, to the west or to the east of Ethiopia. There is currently about 700 U.S. soldiers there, and they are involved in a mission training Somali forces and also African Union forces in the fight against the terrorist organization Al-Shabaab, who is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. They've been there for a number of years. People remember the movie Black Hawk Down, what took place in 1993 there with a couple of U.S. helicopters that were shot out of the sky. The U.S. has basically been there on and off ever since, with an increasing stabilizing presence there that observers are very worried that if the United States decides to leave with its 700 troops, that it could lead to a revival of the terrorist organization in the Horn of Africa.
Well, Donald Trump has been promising these kinds of drawdowns throughout his presidency, even before he was elected. And so this is him following through on those promises. But it is interesting watching what's happening in these areas and the kind of vacuum that will be left by America pulling out. It's not hard to understand why he would prioritize this, given the fact that these have been just intractable problems. Our presence hasn't really solved anything, but in some ways you could see what happens in our absence being even worse.
Right. And that's, you know, we get a lot of feedback when we talk about these programs, the fact that the United States is drawing down, how it's going to be bad for the region and bad for the stability and for the region and good for Iran. We're not arguing that it's not a reasonable position to take to get the U.S. forces out of there with such small numbers, 2,500 and 2,500 in Afghanistan and Iraq. You can't really expect to do too much, so you might as well just get them out of there. However, what we look at is biblical prophecy and that moving forward in the United States' absence, and that's why we have expected Iraq especially to be absent for U.S. forces, because we know that that country is going to totally and completely fall in alongside Iran. In terms of Somalia, though, I think there is it's very significant the timing of the United States' announcement of potential withdrawal, because Al-Shabaab right now is rising in power, and there was just a terrorist attack yesterday in Mogadishu, the capital. 4 people were killed. Al-Shabaab took responsibility for that. There's been a number of attacks in Ethiopia and Kenya. There have been numerous Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda cells that have been busted up and arrested over the past couple of days. And so with the United States leaving that country at the same time that Ethiopia, which has had thousands of troops inside Somalia, also as part of this same mission to target a resurgent Al-Shabaab, they've retreated to fight against its own civil war. You can really see the Horn of Africa being destabilized in a way that the Islamists, especially in Somalia, do take advantage of.
Yeah, the civil war that we've been talking about that's developing within Ethiopia. Essentially, you're saying that the big fallout of this is the fact that it would pull those Ethiopian troops that have been helping to suppress Al-Shabaab out of Somalia, at the same time that the United States, if they follow through with this plan, pulls its troops out. This could really be a boon for this terrorist organization.
Right. And yeah, Ethiopia has already done that. They've already pulled out over the past couple of weeks. And so the Somalis are very worried about this. The U.S. is saying that it can still, you know, have its airstrikes against Al-Shabaab from its base in Djibouti to the north of Somalia. However, what everyone's worried about is the lack of intelligence gathering that'll take place, and how Al-Shabaab will be able to increase in Somalia and pose an increasing threat. I mean, we have been watching the situation of Al-Shabaab in Somalia and their rise, and the way that this could actually impact Ethiopia because of the relationship that Al-Shabaab has had with Iran. And we expect this Horn of Africa region to fall under the sway of radical Islam led by Iran. And the main radical Islamist group, although it's a Sunni power, is Al-Shabaab. This is the group that has been responsible for numerous pirating of ships for the past decade off the Horn of Africa. Also, people will remember that. And they've also got a close relationship with Iran. They're mining uranium that's been shipped to Iran. Iran has armed the Houthis through weapons transfers given to al-Shabaab, the Houthis being the Iranian proxy in Yemen. And so they have a history of a warm relationship, and Iran is looking to take advantage of the destabilized situation in the Horn of Africa. It wants to control the Red Sea passageway, the Gulf of Aden, which is just above Somalia, going through the Bab el-Mandab Strait, 22-mile passageway that leads up into the Red Sea. They have the Houthis there in northern Yemen overlooking that. But they want to cement their control over that region. And Bible prophecy says they will. They will cement their control. And so that's where, why this is significant. The U.S. deciding that it will withdraw from the country that holds the largest radical Islamist power, and Ethiopia withdrawing its troops, and Ethiopia being preoccupied with the fight against the Tigrayans in the north, which will leave the eastern part of Ethiopia, which is heavily Muslim, 95% of Afar, and the other another province on the eastern part next, in Somalia, it's called, in Ethiopia. They're heavily Muslim provinces. And so you could see a spread of al-Shabaab across the border into the vacuum created in eastern Ethiopia also, which could lead to this Iran's influence increasing as well in that nation.
Well, quite a volatile situation there. Where would you send people for more information, and particularly just to understand the prophetic implications of what's happening here?
Well, I think people can go to the article that was written last week about this crisis in Ethiopia, because al-Shabaab is brought into that. The title of that article is Civil War Coming to Ethiopia?
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. A very alarming story out of China, newly declassified evidence that the country is rapidly expanding its nuclear weapons capabilities. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there was a collection of United States intelligence documents that were declassified this week and published by the Washington Times. And this consists of a set of satellite images that basically show that China is engaged in a significant expansion of some of its most important nuclear weapons facilities. So one of these is of China's GCON atomic energy complex. And it shows that over the past 2 years, a plutonium production area inside this complex has doubled in size. So a major expansion underway there. And then the image also shows that the plant has added a new reactor. And then the next image is of the nuclear arms research facility in Mianyang, China. This complex is part of the China Academy of Engineering and Physics. That's the country's main organization for nuclear weapons work. It's where most of their nuclear warhead production and testing take place. And the image shows major expansions underway. So it's clearly preparing to be able to make and to be able to test more nuclear warheads there. And then the third satellite image that I'll cover here is of a military reactor facility in Lishan, China. And this one actually shows that the complex has grown over the last 10 years to 20 times its size. So it's now 20 times what it was back in 2010. So this is a facility that makes components for nuclear weapons and reactors, and it has undergone just a massive expansion. So when you look at all of this together, it just has a lot of nuclear weapons watchdogs deeply concerned. You know, China is notoriously secretive about its nuclear weapons program. It has never even officially said how many warheads it has or exactly what they're all capable of. And now it looks like whatever that number of warheads was, it could very quickly grow much, much larger. The United States State Department chief diplomat for weapons control talked about this imagery this week, and he said, quote, "It is clear from this imagery that China is engaged in a secretive crash buildup of its infrastructure. There is no doubt that China wants to be on par with the United States and Russia in terms of its military and nuclear capabilities." End quote. So, you know, that's China's goal, and these new revelations show that they could achieve it far faster than analysts previously thought.
We've followed China's military buildup and its just how many different areas that it's pushing it aggressively militarily. to add this nuclear dimension to that is quite something. And one of those areas that they've developed has been deployment of these types of warheads, missile technology, that type of thing. They've also advanced that in a way that makes these nuclear revelations that much more alarming.
That's true. That's a great point. They're not just expanding the infrastructure to be able to build more nuclear warheads, but they're also developing the delivery systems for right. them. In 2018 and 2019, China tested, I believe it's about 280 ballistic missiles each year, which is more than the rest of the world combined. So they really want to be able to make sure that they don't just have advanced nuclear warheads, but that they can put them on their targets, you know, with these incredibly advanced missile systems.
So this is at the same time when we've seen Russia, who is aligning more and more with China, developing even more dangerous nuclear technology. You put Russia and China together, and they really are quite a formidable nuclear power team.
For sure. Yeah, this news about China comes just days after Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about some of the major improvements that he has overseen for Russia's nuclear forces. This was at a defense industry meeting, and he stressed the gains that Russia's made in its strategic nuclear forces command and control systems. And then he talked about just nuclear weapons more generally. And he said, quote, "For the first time in history, Russia is not in the position of a runner-up. It has come up with certain weapon systems that are years and even decades ahead of foreign counterparts. Some systems are unparalleled in the world and most likely will remain as such for quite a long time." End quote. And, you know, some of that might sound a little bit exaggerated, but we've talked on the show several times about the new hypersonic nuclear-capable missiles that Russia has developed and successfully tested, and how those are essentially unstoppable, even by America's best defense systems. And it does look like the U.S. and everyone else is not yet at Russia's level with those systems. So just some remarkable gains, not just by China, but also that Russia has made to its nuclear weapons program in recent years.
It's a story that we watch closely because of so many prophecies that show that nuclear weapons are going to play such an integral role in the next global conflict. To see these giants of the East developing this, at some point, these weapons are going to be used.
Yes. Yeah, I think this this darkening nuclear shadow that we see in China and Russia, it might seem like kind of a remote, faraway threat, but it really should grip our attention because, as you said, the Bible says these weapons will be used. There are prophecies about a global war that will erupt in our lifetimes that will have the capacity to wipe out mankind. That's discussed in Matthew 24, 21 through 22, and some other passages. And so that's not talking about any ordinary kind of war, but a civilization-altering event with, you know, so many nuclear weapons detonated that nuclear winter sets in and all human life would die. But the scriptures also show that that war will be supernaturally, divinely interrupted before that happens, before man can annihilate himself. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has written quite a lot about this over the years, about this approaching nuclear war and what it means for each of us. And in his booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, he writes, quote, "We are now at the edge of this nuclear abyss. Only God can solve our number one problem, that of human survival. Men don't know the way of peace, but God knows. And if you keep his law of love, it will bring great joy and peace into your life." End quote. So, you know, as we see China and Russia building up and improving their nuclear weapons, I think it shows just how important it is for each of us to understand more about all of this and to have that peace that Mr. Flurry wrote about in our lives. And so for any listeners who don't already have a copy of that booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, I would encourage them to grab a free copy so they could learn much more about both the problem and the solution.
We will link to that booklet in the show notes for today's program. You can also watch for an article that Jeremiah has written, China's Secretive Nuclear Weapons Buildup Exposed, on this specific subject. That'll be available at thetrumpet.com very soon. Thanks very much, Jeremiah. Now to Europe, which just put together a new budget deal, but as is so often the case, European leaders couldn't agree on it. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is Europe's $2 trillion budget deal and coronavirus recovery package. And first of all, you might be thinking this is November and they're just getting round to approving their coronavirus recovery package. Yeah, that's right. And that not only that, but they failed to do it. They failed to get it through. This whole story just shows how slow moving and unresponsive so much of the European Union structure is right now. But the big deal is Europe was all excited because in this new bailout package, they had something new. They had this arrangement where if a country violated what was deemed as the rule of law, they could have their funding cut off. So this was meant to be a big deal for the European Union because now the European Union has some teeth that it didn't have before. It can snap off the funding of money to countries that do things it doesn't like. Now, you have to understand, for Europe, rule of law normally means what we want you to do or European integration. They always rule in favor of anything that's more Europe. But this was what they put through. Now, I'm not quite sure what they expected to happen, because at the same time as they were pushing this through, they were very excited about punishing Poland and Hungary. And they talked a lot about doing this and about how this will give us now the opportunity to punish Poland and Hungary. So to what should be nobody's surprise, Poland and Hungary just vetoed the whole thing. Like I said, I don't know how they're expecting anything different to happen. We're getting ready to spank you. Can we get your permission, please? I mean, of course, right. The answer is going to be no. So they vetoed it. And you can understand why from their point of view. I mean, we've talked about Hungary and some of their moves towards a kind of a dictatorial state. And I think there's some legitimate concerns for Europe there for Hungary. For Poland, what they're looking at, and they're seeing some of the things that the Polish government is doing to stop homosexuals propagandized to children, for example, or to limit access to abortion. And because the top of the EU is kind of very liberal and elite right now, they don't like that. But anyway, the fact that now this big bailout package and what was meant to be this major step forward for the EU has come once again to a juddering halt, and we're now facing more weeks of negotiation while we still try to implement a bailout package, has got a lot of people saying, well, look, this government and our government structure just isn't working.
Right. That's the bottom line. All of the Europhiles, mm-hmm. all of the Eurocrats, all of the ones who want more EU federal power are looking at this and just saying, here is yet another evidence, another piece of evidence on the mountain of evidence showing that this structure, the European Union structure as it is currently constituted, is impossible. We have to change this. I
mean, like we were saying with coronavirus, and that's been a pretty huge crisis, at least when we're talking about economic terms. And, you know, I think there's a lot of it's been overblown medically, but economically, the damage has been huge. And if it takes you 6 months to react to that kind of a crisis, I mean, how do you survive in the long term? And so what you have with the European Union right now is you have a 27 member state where on most things and certainly on big issues, each of those 27 members has a veto. So once again, you've got people looking and saying, well, 27, that's a bit much. That's hard to get everybody around, and we've got to find a way to get rid of the veto. Now, both of those things, I think, will be hard to overcome. There's a lot of pressure on not kicking people out of the European Union, and it's going to be hard for people to hand over that veto. But it's certainly got a renewed impetus on changing European government quite radically.
So talk about this from a prophetic standpoint. Change, radical change in Europe is exactly what we've been expecting for a long time.
That's right. And we go through all exactly why in a trends article that we have, why the Trumpet watches Europe's ongoing unification project that just lays out what all of the scriptures say. And Herbert W. Armstrong was writing about a United States of Europe, he used the term European Union all the way back in 1945. Because the Bible has a lot of specifics about this coming power. And you can tell from those specifics, it's going to be a group of nations. It's going to be an economic powerhouse. So he was saying in 1945, you're going to have this countries come together in Europe. It's going to start on the economic field, and then it's going to become political. And he was all the way along watching and warning. And he said, it's going to be hard for it to come together politically. It's going to take some pressure, but it's going to happen. And we also, the same scriptures that informed those forecasts that we can already see were remarkably accurate, tell us that there's got to be a very different type of European Union. The Bible talks about a power that's not made up of 27 nations, but made up of 10 nations or groups of nations, 10 powers. And it's a much more autocratic one, one that does react quickly and even ferociously at times, not getting bogged down in all of these divisions. Now, the Bible also does tell us it's not this completely harmonious relationship, but still, there's a big change that's got to happen. And Revelation chapter 17 is one of the passages that lists so many of those changes, talking about it being a 10-nation power, talking about it being ruled by one king. But that that Trends article will take you through those scriptures, show why Mr. Armstrong was able to make that forecast, why we know that those scriptures apply to modern Europe, and that's why the Trumpet watches Europe's ongoing unification project.
All right, very good. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We will take a short break. Stick around.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
How strong is the Trump administration's support for the state of Israel? An unprecedented visit from America's Secretary of State gives us a strong idea. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Nachtigall.
Yes, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was in Israel as part of his European and Middle Eastern trip. He was here on Wednesday and Thursday. And he had a series of really big firsts for a United States Secretary of State, and that is he went up into the Golan Heights, gave a few messages up there, and this is obviously a place that the United States under President Trump has declared to be Israeli territory underneath Israeli sovereignty. And then Mr. Pompeo also visited a winery inside a settlement inside the West Bank. This winery has been blacklisted by European companies and is one of the poster childs of the BDS, the Boycott and Divestment Sanction Organization against Israel, have tried to target this winery. They actually have a blend of red grapes called Pompeo.
We got to try a bottle of this, Brent.
So he went and he actually tried that also. And then you had a speech that was given by him, which was really interesting, which he's talked about how everything that is made inside the West Bank, the United States position is that it can have a made in Israel stamp. He said, quote, "The State Department has historically taken the wrong view of settlements, which he claimed can," "can be done in a way that is lawful, appropriate, and proper," saying that the settlements are okay. They're not against the law inside the West Bank. And of course, everyone, every NGO, every European nation, the EU is up in arms over this. How mm-hmm. dare the United States accept this position of by the Israeli government that these settlements are legal because they are against them. And then one final place he visited was actually the city of David. He visited the tourist center that is located atop the Palace of David. He went there on Wednesday evening. He had a tour by Zev Orenstein, who is the international director for the City of David Foundation. He actually tweeted out a picture of part of that tour. And this is what he said in that tweet: "Wonderful to see work being done to preserve the ancient city of David and the new discoveries by archaeologists working in the area." So that's the Secretary of State, Mr. Mike Pompeo, having a whirlwind trip of the state of Israel, particularly visiting settlements on the Golan Heights in the West Bank, and then heading down to the city of David to look at work being done in the excavations there.
Israelis who are watching this happen really have to be somewhat wistful as they contemplate the possibility of a Joe Biden administration coming in his place, because there really has never been a supporter of Israel on the scale of what we're seeing out of the Trump administration.
Yeah, I mean, if Israelis were voting in that election, it would have been 65% for President Trump, because they really do support what he's done for their state, and plenty of Israelis they don't believe he's done and out either. He thinks the media, of course, is on board with Trump leaving. However, we've got this same article that was posted as a Trumpet brief by the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet, the one that called that President Trump will remain in office, and it's up on Watch Jerusalem, and right on our Facebook page. It's had over 160 comments on it that are mostly, 90% of them are Israelis, and a lot of them are very supportive of it, and a lot of them believe that he will remain. And a lot of them are praying, they say, that he will remain just because he is so good, obviously, to the Jewish people. And so it will be interesting. They are hoping for a continuation of the Trump administration, although the media wants Biden, even over here, the media wants Biden to be president. However, we know that's not going to be the case, and the state of Israel is rejoicing by the continued support.
Thank you, Brent. China is operating drug cartels in Mexico. Some analysts say this is actually part of China's larger strategy to undermine America. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we had some new reports from Fortress Risk Management, and those reports were obtained exclusively by Fox News. But they're reporting that a new cartel in China called Los Zhang is using veterinary services, clothing sales, clinical laboratories, and computer maintenance shops to run one of the largest drug trafficking networks in Mexico. It's using those other organizations as like the front or facade to keep some of their activities under wraps. But they really dominate the fentanyl and the methamphetamine markets. Those are the two synthetic markets. Now, the drugs like marijuana, heroin, cocaine that are grown from plants in the area is still dominated by the native Mexican cartels, the Sinaloa cartel and the like. But the fentanyl and the methamphetamine, those are derived from chemicals that are mainly produced in Wuhan, China. It seems like there's just all sorts of... I've never been to Wuhan, China, but it sounds like a horrible place. But it's... But yeah, those chemicals, they come in through the ports. They ship them across the ocean to the ports on the Pacific side of Mexico and then traffic them into the United States. So in the past, they've been selling them a lot to the big cartels in Mexico. Now they're kind of almost getting their own Chinese-run drug cartel that's moving these drugs into the United States. But as you mentioned, there's also a number of analysts who've at least heavily speculated that they're doing this with the permission of the Chinese government. During the Cold War, that the Chinese were more overt on their desire to use drugs to undermine the United States from within. And this type of activity, I mean, the Chinese government claims it's just criminals, but they haven't done much to stop these criminals, and they're definitely carrying out a same type of foreign policy that we've seen carried out as a deliberate Chinese government offensive against America in the past. Peter Zeehan at Stratford, or earlier he was at Stratford, at least at the time. I haven't kept up with his writings as much recently, but he has an article from 2008 really explaining that he's like, for the communist powers, Russia and China, to attack the United States, he's like, they've really got three tools at their disposal. Work towards naval blockade, undermine U.S. society with drugs, and try to get enough of a foothold in like Central American states, Mexico and Central American states, to prepare for to challenge America's territorial integrity, and the drug trade really hits two of those. One, it's you're moving drugs into the United States to undermine your society from within, and by making Mexico a failed state, you're challenging America's territorial integrity. China couldn't just invade the U.S. right now, right away, without risking World War III. But if you can make a failed state where you're flooding the nation with thousands of immigrants and drug cartel criminals and that like, that also weakens the United States. And I guess the calculus in the Cold War was to use the drugs and the immigrants and the other things to undermine America to such a point that they could actually use their bases in Cuba and other Latin American places to like seize control of the Panama Canal, the Yucatan Channel, the Straits of Florida, and cut the U.S. off from world trade. You'd have to sow quite a bit of chaos within the United States for the U.S. military to just stop you from doing that. But it was a plan that a lot of Cold War historians talked about. And it, when you look at China's activities with Seagate's in the Caribbean, building a presence in the Caribbean, selling drugs in Mexico, it looks like they're trying to continue that plan.
This is really the type of behavior that America doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to. You said that this is a way of waging war against the United States without kind of hitting the radar screen and starting World War III. Americans are so preoccupied to really take note of something like this that's taking place on such a low level in some ways. You could see how vulnerable it would make the United States because of our failure to recognize when an enemy is really coming after us.
Right, and if it wasn't for all the internal division and Black Lives Matter riots and fights over rigged elections, a story like this, which I almost missed, mm-hmm. Really should have been headline news.
Right.
That like the Chinese are manufacturing drugs in Wuhan, shipping them into Mexico, traffic them into the United States, and there are people saying that the government might be purposely turning a blind eye to it because they want it to happen. I mean, that's a huge story. One of the articles we'll put in the show notes is titled Preparing to Storm America's Castle. That was co-authored by myself and Mr. Jacques, that just really lays out the statistics about Seagate's and Latin American nations that China is trying to get control of as part of a plan to cripple the United States economy.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Andrew. Preparing to Storm America's Castle. We'll link to that in the show notes for the program today. Really fascinating subject, and we do need to follow up on this to see how this develops. And it is a bigger story than what is being recognized. Thank you for that. Vladimir Putin has been lamenting the fall of the Soviet Union and trying to rebuild that former superpower. One of the countries he's working on is Uzbekistan. To learn about the latest of his efforts, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Thursday that Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu spoke to his counterpart in Uzbekistan. And they talked about just a wide range of topics that have one common thread, and that is military technical cooperation between Russia and Uzbekistan. So details are never really disclosed from these types of meetings, but with such high-level players involved, it does show that Russia's military partnership with Uzbekistan is set to grow much stronger. And then this week we also learned that Russia is engaged in a major project to boost Uzbekistan's production of oil and natural gas. The reports say that Moscow has about $650 million worth of funds earmarked for this. So, you know, quite a substantial sum there. And it could well be that all that investment money has played a role in the new high-level talks and the efforts by these two nations to take their military cooperation to the next level.
So I kind of hinted at it in the introduction, but just talk about Vladimir Putin's interest in this country.
Yeah, sure. I think it's very important to watch what he's doing with Uzbekistan, in large part because, as you said, Uzbekistan was part of the Soviet Union. You know, it was one of those 14 republics that were welded into one giant superpower under Russia's power. Early in his reign, Putin said that he thought the collapse of that Soviet Union was the 20th century's greatest geopolitical catastrophe. And we've seen him over the years do everything he can to just kind of undo that catastrophe, to bring as much of the old Soviet territory as possible back under Russian control. We saw that with Georgia in 2008. We saw it with Ukraine in 2014 and even up to the present. That's also, I think, a big factor in what we spoke about last week with Putin sending troops into the Nagorno-Karabakh region that Azerbaijan and Armenia were fighting over. In all of those former Soviet nations, Putin is bringing parts of them back under Russia's control. And now it looks like he may be setting his sights on Central Asia and specifically on Uzbekistan. So yeah, it's very significant, I think, just because it'll be a major step in his goal of rebuilding that Soviet Union.
Talk about his role in biblical prophecy.
Sure, yes. Well, it's really important to keep a vigilant eye on Putin and his grip on power inside of Russia, but also outside of Russia, on the country's neighbors. And that's because prophecy talks about an end-time multinational Asian power that will actually be led not just by Russia, but mainly by one certain Russian individual. Ezekiel 38 calls this man the Prince of Rosh, or the Prince of Russia. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has said that Putin is that man. You know, Mr. Fleury has admonished our audience to watch him closely as he keeps on asserting more control over Russia and over Russia's neighbors, and especially those former Soviet nations. So for anyone who would like to know how to watch him more closely and to understand that in the prophetic context, I would recommend Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. We will finish today's program back in Europe. The presumptive heir to the British crown made a visit to Germany, and one that brings to mind a specific biblical prophecy. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Prince Charles was the first member of the royal family to take part in Germany's National Day of Mourning. This is kind of the remembrance ceremony in Germany for its war dead and that kind of thing. And it was the first royal visit to Germany as well since the UK left the EU at the end of the year. And during that, he gave a speech where he talked a lot about how close the UK and Germany is, the ties that they've had together over the centuries, those things about Germans and Germany that the British people admire and respect, and what Germany admires and respects about Britain. And then he concluded by talking a lot about the deep level of trust between these two countries. For example, he said towards in his conclusion, "It is therefore my heartfelt belief that the fundamental bond between us will remain strong. We will always be friends, partners, and allies." So just one of the most dogmatic and solid expressions of confidence in the British-German relationship.
To hear British officials talking like this about Germany is really quite something, and this is kind of the trend in Britain. After you had, for a long time, you had a lot of strong hatred against Germany in the wake of World War II for obvious reasons. Now it seems like the trend is in the opposite direction, where anyone who says anything condemning or expressing any kind of distrust of Germany is kind of censured. And Prince Charles is right in the same train.
He is, and that's where this ties directly into Bible prophecy. I mean, I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with some of the admiration that he expressed, and he made some good points about, you know, George Frederick Handel coming over from Germany and having a massive influence on the English musical tradition and things like that, to the point that we still play his music in coronations today. There are some great successes, I think, when these two countries work together. But the Bible talks about how Britain trusts in other nations. It talks about it in terms of lovers. It talks about Britain and America, instead of looking to God for protection and defense, or even just to the blessings God has given them for protection and defense, turning to other nations, other lovers, to come protect them. There's another very specific prophecy in Hosea chapter 5 that talks about when Ephraim sees his sickness, he turns to basically it's talking about turning to Germany for help there, for the solution to that. So it's this level of just complete trust that Prince Charles expressed in that speech that is exactly what the Bible prophesied. And you could see this even taking off even more. I think most of the world doesn't like the vision projected by of America. I mean, they're seeing a vision of America through the lens of the American news media. The news media is giving them a picture of Donald Trump as an absolute monster, and they're looking for another way, another leader. And Germany is standing out more and more as the alternative for that. And I think that's another interesting angle of this prophecy of where we're all turning to Germany. And Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald had an interesting article on that aspect of this story several years ago called "We're All Falling in Love with Germany." And what I find interesting about this article is what really triggered this article was some comments made by the then mayor of London about how utterly preposterous it would be to mistrust Germany. And how trustworthy Germany is, how solid this alliance is, how Germany needs to come out and forget about its history and be bold and confident in the world scene. And that mayor of London that made all those comments was Boris Johnson, the man who is now our prime minister. So this trend of Britain looking to Germany and really the world looking to Germany is something that has just increased and increased.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. "We're All Falling in Love with Germany" is the name of the article that we'll put on the show notes. We'll link to there, along with all of the other booklets and books that we've talked about in the articles. And that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of John Stuart Mill: "The person who has nothing for which he is willing to fight, nothing which is more important than his own personal safety, is a miserable creature and has no chance of being free unless made and kept so by the exertions of better men than himself." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.